Yeah, this is cool. This is awesome. Like, we only have hot dogs at the things we do in our church, but this is, I might call them to a higher level. I just want to say this in case I don't get to say it later. What I'm going to talk about tonight, just briefly, all of it's on this CD. There's a whole manual on here, and I think 15 hours of speaking that we did on the topic I'm going to talk about tonight. So these are available up there somewhere. I think they're $10, but it'll be awesome. I know some guys here, I talked to them, have already been through some of this, and I think you'll really, really enjoy it as men. So tonight, I was actually thinking about three instances in my life today, especially when I'm talking about this particular topic. The topic is, what's my identity and destiny in life? That's what I want to talk about. Now, when I say identity, I talked a little bit about it on Sunday, but when I say identity, I mean, what is the name that God calls me personally? Names are very important to God. We're going to look at this in a second. But he calls people by name, and he changes people's names to a new name as he meets them, as he redeems them. And this name defines their future, their destiny. If you want to know what your destiny is in this world, you need to know the name that God calls you. This isn't, especially for men, this is really important. So I was thinking about three times in my life where my identity was very important to the outcome of the situation I was in. The first one that I was thinking about was I was in the police department in D.C., and me and my partner, who was called the troll for a lot of reasons, which he deserved, but we called him the troll, and he was the guy that trained me, and so when I was cut loose, you know, on my own, we worked a lot together, actually. So he and I were together one night, and a murder call came out. It just happened. A guy with a shotgun shot a security guard at some shopping center. So it was about 9 o'clock at night. So it comes out, description of the car. We're not too far away. So we go into the area where it's happened. And we're just actually driving through apartment complexes because they had a tag number, but they weren't sure about it. So they had a flag on the tag number. So we had a computer in our car, and we're just driving through these apartment complexes, running tags. He's driving, I'm just running tags through the computer. And so we get into this one townhouse complex near the scene, see a car that looks like it matches the description, run the tag, and the buzzer goes off, flags it. So we think, okay, this could be our guy. So it's parked right in front of this townhouse. So being the brilliant police officers we were, just went up and banged on the door. And like, if he's dumb enough to open, we'll get an awesome arrest. If not, we'll have to rethink this. But so a guy opens the door. We have a description, not a very good description of the person. But the guy opens the door. He's obviously not our guy. But there's a lot of people inside this townhouse, a lot of men. And so we kind of talk our way in and get everybody lined up against the wall. It was a rough neighborhood. It wasn't a lot of courtesy involved on either side. And a lot of name calling, but anyway, so we get these guys lined up against the wall. There's six of them. We're IDing them. Not our guy. But one of the guys in the line, he keeps looking up, like upstairs, like that. He'd look at me and he'd go, like that. And so we're like, okay. And so we move these guys out of the townhouse. And so we start going up. It's a split foyer. We start going up the stairs. And in the split level, the landing is a shotgun case, like just thrown on the floor. And so we're like, wow, this could really be our guy. And like he was loading it going up the stairs or something because there's shells. So we go up to the top, and I say to the troll, because he's like 10 years more senior than I am, I said, we probably ought to get some backup here. And he said, yeah, we will. Let's check it out first. So that's why we called him the troll. But anyway, so I said, okay, all right, whatever. And so we get up to the top floor, and there's three rooms, one on the left, one in the middle, and one on the right. And but there's no light up there. It's like there's the lights out or something in the hallway. So we check the one. It's clean. Check the one in front of us. It's clear. The one down here is the door's closed. So we're like both up against the wall sliding down the hall. And I turn the knob of the door and kind of push it open, and someone inside kicks it shut and locks it. So I look at the troll, and I was like, I think this is our guy, and we got to check it out. So the troll says, well, let's do this. He said, let's hit the door. Let's break it down. And when we get inside, you know, you spread out as fast as you can, because the person in the room, he's killed one person. He just shoots, you know, right at the light or whatever. So you spread out as fast as you can. So he has to like do this number. And so the troll says, okay, one of us will go in first. And I'm thinking, oh man. So he says, one of us will go in first. And that person who goes in first will hit the floor and roll and hit the flashlight to light the room. And the other one will go in to the left and shoot. This way we called him the troll. And that was his strategy. Turn on the light and shoot. So I said, all right. And he knows I'm a Christian. He knows I'm a believer because he trained me. But so I said, well, who goes first? And he said, well, you're a Christian, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And he says, you're sure you're going to go to heaven if you die, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And he said, I'm not. So you go first. So that made sense to me. But he said, but you know, I was raised, he's an Irish Catholic guy. He said, I was raised Catholic. So maybe you could just say a real quick prayer before we do this. So I prayed, and there you go. 1, 2, 3, bam. I hit the door, go straight into the room, hit the floor, roll to the right. He comes in right behind me with his, you know, with his gun out, with his back up against the wall, aiming. The problem was when I hit the floor, my flashlight broke in half. Just like on TV. It was awesome. And so I'm hitting the button. It's pitch black. And nothing's, like, I see the head of my flashlight laying over there. Great police issue. And he's going, turn on the light. It's like, my flashlight broke. Like this. I know he's just going to start shooting probably. And so, but I felt like something was wrong in the room. I just could feel it like in my heart or whatever you want to call it. And so in the corner of the room where he was aiming, there was a curtain and just a little bit of light would come in off the street. And in the corner, we could see a man standing there and we could see a gun. And so the troll, I can hear him, you know, he's loading up to unload. And I just said to him, wait, hold on a second. And so, I mean, this is all really fast. And so he says, what? And I just said to the Lord, I need to know if this is the right thing to do right now. Do we shoot? We need to know right now. And so in that instance, it's like, if hearing from God is real, then we could be in a situation where only God knows what's actually going on. And we want to be really good cops. I mean, we're super professional. Our equipment wasn't, but we were. And so we wanted to do the right thing, but we don't exactly know what to do. So if I pray and say, God, will you speak to me right now? And God's the kind of God that goes, well, you didn't really go to church Sunday, so I can't really talk to you. If he's that kind of God, we're in big trouble. Thing is, he's not. So that incident I was thinking about, and then another one I was thinking about, I'll come back to that, was went through that, got recruited by the CIA, went into work in the militant Muslim world, worked through that. Ended up doing our own sort of thing in the Middle East among Muslims. And one night I came out of a class I was teaching in Amman, Jordan. And we had a rule when we lived in Baghdad, especially, but also in Jordan, you never get in a car with people you don't know. Because when you get in a car, it's hard to get out. And so it's easier to run from a car than be in it. So I'm coming out of my class, walking down the street, trying to get a taxi home. And this car stops with four guys in it, four Muslim guys. And the two in the front, I kind of know. And I know who they are. And they're bad guys. They are bad guys. They've both been in prison in Israel. The Jordanian police made them report every month. And so I know they're bad guys. The two in the back, I don't know. And so they say to me, the one guy, he says to me, one of them has a big burn across his face from a phosphorus bomb in Iraq, courtesy of the USA. And so the one on the passenger side says, hey, where are you going? Then I said, I'm going home. And they said, get in. You'll never get a taxi. Get in. We'll give you a ride home. So I'm thinking, I'm not going to get in the car with these guys. But I said, Lord, but I don't know. Like, maybe this is something you want. So I said, Lord, do you want me to get in the car? Now, again, I'm trusting wholly on the fact that God speaks, that he still speaks to us. And we know he does through his word, but there's situations, you know, you can't really hold. Can I look this up, you guys, for a second? Let me see what to do here. So I just said, Lord, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to get in? And I felt very strongly that he did, which is counter to what I would have done. So I said, all right. So one guy gets out in the back seat. I get between them in the back seat between the two guys. And they start driving through the city. And the guy in the front says, where do you live? And I tell him. And he makes a U-turn and starts going the opposite way. And I was like, okay, Lord, you did say get in, didn't you? It wasn't anything like don't get in and I'd miss the first word because this isn't working out already. So we're driving in the opposite direction and the guy in the front seat turns around. They're Islamic Jihad guys. Turns around and he looks at me and he said, you know, when we were in Palestine, we had an American working there and we picked him up one night because we knew he was either from the CIA or he was some kind of missionary, both of which we don't like. And I was like, darn, they got me on both. Shoot. There's not a third option in this. And he said, so we picked him up at night, just like we've picked you up, and we take him to an Islamic cleric and put him on trial, and then we cut their throat, and that's where we're taking you right now. And then he goes, what do you think about that? What do I think about that? And so I said, Lord, with all of my training, I think I can get out of the car, but it's going to be very costly to me, and I probably won't make it. I can cause a lot of damage, but I don't think I can get out of this one. So I need you to tell me exactly what to do in this situation. And he did. He told me exactly what to do. So that was the second one. And then the third one... The third situation I was thinking about was just recent, because we live in Atlanta now, getting ready to move back into the Middle East in November. And we're living in Atlanta, and our downtown church, our midtown campus, has a really strong outreach into prostitution, child trafficking, all that kind of thing. And so the girl that leads the women's side of it, Courtney, the women go into these apartment complexes where the prostitutes stay with their kids and all that stuff. And these are flop houses. And they go in there and they go around and knock on doors and take clothes and food and share the kingdom with these prostitutes who most of them start at age 13. So they meet this one girl. She's 23 now, started at 13. So she's been a prostitute for 10 years, wasted on crack, has two kids in this squalor. And they start sharing the kingdom with, and the Lord really speaks to this woman. Her name is Sheena. And the only reason I say her name is because she's given her testimony so publicly in Atlanta in the last few months. But the Lord just really speaks to her, transforms her. She decides she's leaving the whole thing. She tells her pimp/boyfriend that she's done. She's leaving. And he makes fun of her, like, you've never even been to high school. What are you going to do? And she said, I don't care. I'll do anything but this. And Jesus will help me. And he's like, yeah, right. But she does. And she walks away and she leaves it. And he's really amazed by it, actually. And this guy's been in prison most of his life. And he's pretty shocked that she just walked away. And she left, you know, what was pretty good money, I guess. And she got a job in a factory. just laboring in a factory. And he couldn't believe that she did it. And so he said to her, I want to meet these people that talk to you about this stuff. And so she said, okay. And so she calls the girls that met her, and she said, can you, my boyfriend, whatever, he was also the father of their two little girls, wants to meet who the people that talk to me about God, because he's a little bit mad, but he's mostly surprised at the power in it, and he wants to hear about this. But he is mad, just warning you. And so the girl, Courtney, our lead lady, she calls me and another guy. And she said, you know, I know you've been in this world. And she said, could you come talk with this guy? She's bringing him to church on Sunday. And I said, okay. So we're sitting in our very young Georgia Tech, University of Georgia white church. And I'm sitting in the back with the guy that's going to talk with me to this guy. And my wife is sitting next to me, and the worship music is going. And I said to, well, the one guy, the guy that was, I was going to show how to talk to this guy, he said to me, how will we recognize him when he comes in? And I was like, look at the people in our church. I think we'll notice him when he walks in. And so I said, we're like on a different planet from this guy. I mean, we're in a different world from this guy. And then my wife said, I said to her, he's going to hate this music in our church. And she's like, why? It's so, and you know, she's waving her hands and she's so, it's so beautiful. Like, and I said, look at our worship leaders. We have fantastic worship leaders. Nothing wrong with them. I love them. They're amazing. But you know, they had their haircuts cost more than most people make in a month, you know? And so for this guy to walk into this kind of rich white environment would be, I said, he's just going to feel uncomfortable. So anyway, she comes in, Sheena, and she's tough. And so, and he comes in behind her, and he's a, you know, when you're in prison most of your life, you just lift weights. That's what you do. And he was a big guy, a strong guy. And so he comes in and he sits in kind of in the middle, and he's kind of agitated the whole time. And so when it was over, he stands up and he comes back with her to the back. And we have about 1,200 in that church in a service. And so he comes back through all the people, and I can tell he's very uncomfortable. And he walks, and I just step in, and I said, look, you know, my name's Jamie. His name is James. And I said, I know you came here with Sheena. I know you have some questions. And I said, I know you hate this place. I know you feel uncomfortable here. And I said, and I know that me and you live in different worlds. I said, so all I want to know is, what do you want? Let's just cut through all of the stuff. What do you want? And he said, I want to know my calling in life. That's what I want to know. He said, God apparently talked to Sheena. I've been in prison most of my life. I've never heard him talk. I want to hear him talk to me, and I want to know why I was born. And my friend, he's a great guy. I'm 51, same age as me. He's a graduate of Dallas Seminary. He looks at me and goes, they didn't teach us that. And I said, I know, dude. And I said, okay, do you want to know your calling? He said, yep. And you know, his language is way more colorful than what I'm saying. And I said, okay, let's go downstairs to a room and let's find out what it is. And he said, all right. And we're walking down. He goes, are you saying you know my calling in life? And I said, nope, I don't. How would I know? Just met you. And I said, I guarantee you this guy doesn't know. He didn't know his own calling in life. So, but I said, but God does, and he will tell you right now what it is. So he goes, all right. So it's kind of like this showdown to the guy. He's kind of like getting into it, because this is kind of how he lives. And so we go into this room, and I'm sitting across from him, and my buddy John's over there. And I said, okay, here's what we're going to do together. I said, first of all, can I sit next to you? Is that okay? And he's like, yeah, whatever. And so I sit next to him. I said, can I put my hand on you? Is that all right with you? Because I'm serious. This guy could have killed me and John before John, you know, covered up his Izod emblem on his shirt. And I said, so can I put my hand on you? And he said, yeah. And so I put my hand on him. And I said, God, we don't want a lot of fluff here. Here's what James wants to know. He wants to know what's his call and why did you make him? And you're the only one that knows. And we need you to tell him now. Now, if God speaks, we're golden there. If he doesn't, we're in serious trouble. Now, here's the problem, my challenge. We don't think he speaks like that. And because we don't believe that, we would never do something like that or get in a car with Islamic Jihad guys in the Middle East or bust into a room where pretty much you know you ought to shoot and wait and say, God, is there something here we don't know? Because if he does speak and he can take you out of those situations, not only alive, but successfully, then you're talking about the most amazing life a man could live, if that's true. Because what happens if that works and that's true, you become fearless. Not particularly brave, but fearless. Because what's there to be afraid of then, if this is true? The way that you can figure out whether that's true or not is by starting with the question, God, what's the name that you call me? That you call me. And out of that name comes your destiny. Now, I'm going to just look at three guys in the Bible real quick. I'm just going to show you a pattern. I'm not going to preach on these guys. I'm just going to show you a pattern. So I'm going to start with Moses, and I'm going to do one chapter on Moses, one section on Moses. And you can check this out because I'm going to kind of paraphrase it. Here's my premise. All through Scripture, you will find, whether men or women, that the person, listen carefully to me, knows in their heart, apart from God, who they are. They know. Now, apart from God, they can't get it. They can't get to it. But they still know it. It's in there. Because everyone is knit together in their mother's womb by God. And when he puts you together with an identity. That's what makes abortion a horrific issue. It's because those identities are intact and they're being killed. Whatever your view is on that, that's tragic. So every person here was given an identity in their mother's womb. The goal of our relationship with God and the reason why we need God is to know what that identity is and how to be it. Because that is the deepest sense of happiness you will ever know. It doesn't come through women. It doesn't come through money. It doesn't come through jobs. It comes from I am being who I was made to be. It's a famous quote by Kierkegaard, the philosopher. He said, with God's help, I'm becoming who I am already. The problem is there's an enemy out there whose strategy is for us to never know that. Because if we do, life is very different. And if we know our identity, then we know our destiny. And if we know our destiny, we know where to live. We know what job to take. And we know what to do. And we don't spend time, I shouldn't have done that. That was a dumb idea. And if you're married, you have two people telling you that on a fairly regular basis when you make a mistake. That was a dumb idea. And I already told myself that. So thank you for affirming that in my life. It's my helpmeet. Thank you. So let's think about Moses for a second. All of Moses' formative years are in one chapter. So you're going to read the whole story of Moses. It's an amazing story. But chapter 2 is the most important chapter about his life because it's Moses discovering his identity. So if you think we can read through this, but you can check me out on it. So you remember the story. Moses is born at a time when all of the power of Pharaoh, which is probably the greatest power in the world at the time, and the Hebrews are slaves, so they have absolutely no recourse against this power. So when this power says you have to live like this, they have to do it. So the decree goes out because the Hebrews are becoming too large in population. Kill all the male children. That's the rule of the land. Kill all the male children. Now, so Pharaoh is very powerful, but he's not as powerful as the midwives of the slaves. Because here's what it says about them. They feared God more than they feared Pharaoh. Can you imagine that? Can you say, I'm more afraid of God than any economic situation I ever find myself in? I'm more afraid of him. And because they feared God more, they delivered male children, and God blessed them for it. So all of the power of Pharaoh couldn't affect these defiant women. And so Moses is born, and his parents, who also are described in Hebrews 11 as people more afraid of Pharaoh, more afraid of God than Pharaoh, so they save their child. And because that, they're great people of faith. So Moses is born. So Moses, in the first infant act of his life, defies a decree of Pharaoh and succeeds. So there's the beginning of his identity. He is a person who will take on the power of Pharaoh, and he will win. So he's born, they put him out, you know, in the Nile, and they watch him. And then Pharaoh's family is out there, the women, and they find him. And he's a very beautiful child, and they have mercy on him. So again, this is what's happening. All of the power of Pharaoh is aimed at killing Moses as an infant, and it does not prevail. So we got to think about, what are we afraid of in this life? We need to think, we are afraid of a lot, men in particular. And so Pharaoh's raised, Moses is raised up in the household of Pharaoh. Not only does he defy them and succeed, he benefits from their wealth, which is what's going to happen when the Israelites leave Egypt. So what's Moses thinking about God? Wow. He saved me in the midst of this oppression. I'm living inside the house of the enemy and prospering. Why? So then Moses is, he loves his people, the Hebrews. And so he's out walking around one day because he loves to go look at them. And he sees an Egyptian guard hurting a Hebrew slave. And what does he do? He kills him. I mean, that's a pretty strong reaction. Like, he could have put the guy in jail. He could have reported him to Pharaoh. He personally kills him. Why? Why doesn't he walk away? He can't. You know why? Because what he was made to be is a deliverer of oppressed people. And when he encounters it, he must act. He must. He doesn't know God yet. But he knows in this situation, this is what I do. I don't care who it is. This is what I do. Now, if I was driving around, you know, and I saw an incident where someone's hurting someone else, I wouldn't get out and kill them. You know, that would be like a little drastic. But this is everything in Moses' being screams against this injustice. Because he's a deliverer, that's what he is. So he goes out the next day, he's walking around, and he sees two Hebrews arguing, and he interrupts them, he breaks it up, and one of the Hebrews looks at him and said, "Who appointed you prince over us?" You know what Moses' title will be in the future? He's the prince over them. They said, "Are you over us?" Yes. But Moses doesn't know that yet. And they say, "Are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian?" And then Moses, in that instant, he trades this identity of deliverer for murderer. Do you see that? So God is raising up a deliverer, and in this situation where Moses doesn't have God yet, that identity becomes murderer. And you'll find, as we talk about identity in just a couple of minutes, the identity that you have for yourself, the names that the world calls you, the names that that some of our spouses call us because, you know, you're not a good husband. You're not a good provider. You're not a good father. You're not a good church attender. All those names that we know so well, that we hear so clearly, come straight from the enemy. And they are 180 degrees opposite to the name that God actually calls you. That's the strategy of the enemy. Deliverer, no, murderer. Deliverer, deliver the people. Murderer, go in exile. It's the opposite life. But now Moses has taken on this identity, and now Pharaoh's after him. And suddenly he's afraid of Pharaoh. His whole life he's never been afraid of Pharaoh. Suddenly he flees from Pharaoh and the very people that he's to deliver. And he goes. And it's interesting, he goes into exile and he comes up to the well with the Midianites. And he's like, oh, I've lost it. And he looks up, and there's the Midianites trying to drive the women away from the well. What does he do? He goes and fights them. Why? You're an exiled murderer. I mean, this thing ain't going to work. There's a situation, oppressed people, oppressor. I'm going to fight the oppressor. I can't help it. I got to do it. And he delivers the women. Then he serves them. And they go and tell their father, there's an Egyptian guy, because he, you know, obviously looked Egyptian. There's an Egyptian guy that came and defended us and then served us. You know why he did that? Because that's his name. That's who he is. But he can't get it yet because he doesn't know God. And so he goes out in the desert and it says he's on the backside of the desert, which in the colloquial, in the Hebraic, means this side of the desert. That's how far away he is. In chapter 3, he meets God, and God says to him, I will make you the greatest deliverer that ever lived. But you have to remember, apart from me, greatest deliverer turns into exile murderer. Pick which one you want. With me, we'll do it. I will do it, actually. Without me, this is your life. What do you want? 9-to-5 shepherd, the rest of your life. Make a minimum wage in a crappy economy, or greatest deliverer that ever lived. Choose. And then Moses goes to it like, wait a minute, Lord. You don't seem to understand me. Me, the greatest deliverer. I have a speech problem. Who do I say sends me? And then he goes through all the reasons why he's accepting this false identity. And the Lord keeps saying, wrong. Nope. Wrong. Nope. Not true. That's not true about you. That's what God does when he intersects our lives. Tell me who you think you are, the Lord says to us. And we say, well, I'm an average husband with a fairly decent job. And God's like, that's what you think about yourself? Who told you that? That's not how I talk to people. You're the greatest deliverer that ever lived. He gives Moses his identity and says, let's go get it. And now Moses has a destiny and he goes after it. That's one man. If you turn to Galatians 1, here's another. So if we look at Saul/Paul, Saul had a big identity change. He was one thing living as Saul. He's a very another thing living as Paul, but they're the same vision. And so Paul, actually, he describes it often through his epistles. But in Galatians 1, if you just read his description of himself, it's really fascinating. He says, I have to read this one. Okay, verse 13. This is chapter 1, verse 13. He's describing himself. He's describing false thinking. And he says, for you have heard of my former conduct in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God beyond measure and tried to destroy it. And I advanced in Judaism beyond many of my contemporaries in my own nation, being more exceedingly zealous for the traditions of my father. Here's Saul's identity. Here's his goal in life. His goal in life is to be the greatest Jewish teacher that ever lived. That's his goal. Now, the way he's pursuing that is to destroy the church. So here's the potential of the greatest Jewish writer / teacher that's ever lived that is nothing more than a terrorist. That's all he is. That's all he's turned out to be. In fact, when Stephen is stoned and Paul, Saul, is standing nearby, it says he gives his consent. That word consent means he applauds it. He claps over it. Oh, God, you got to be proud of me now. We just killed this guy, another Christian gone. You got to be proud of me now. There's a lot of people in the world like that now. And he applauds it. So here's Paul, Saul's dream for his life. He said, Paul, what do you want to be? What's the goal of your life? To be the greatest Jewish writer of all time. Never forgotten by the world. How you doing? Well, I'm at the terrorism level right now. But I'm ahead of everybody else. Right dream, right goal, can't do it without God. And so here's what he says. Verse 14. Well, and so I advanced in Judaism, more zealous than everybody else. 15. But when it pleased God, look at this, who separated me from my mother's womb and called me through his grace to reveal his son in me that I might preach him among Gentiles, I did not immediately confer with flesh and blood. So here's what he's saying. This word called here in this passage, when at the right time God called me, he revealed this to me. The word call there means named me. He called me by my real name, my real identity, which, you know what it is? To be the greatest Jewish writer that ever lived, but way beyond what he was hoping. Into the Gentiles even. Right goal. Without Christ, terrorism. With Christ, yes, that's it. You're right. In your mother's womb, I made you to be that. And this is the day I'm revealing it to you. So now if you ask Paul, what's his name? Paul, what's your identity? Called to the Gentiles. Even more specifically, what's your name? Called to the Gentiles in places where no one's ever been before. Right? Far, far greater than anything he ever strove for. Far beyond all he could ask or imagine. When was that put inside of him? In his mother's womb. This can be the Damascus Road night. When God says, now I'm going to reveal to you who you really are. You know why? Because you're finally asking me and not telling me. Because I know you better. I put you together. And the reason you can't get it, can't quite lay hold of it, is because you won't let me lead the way. And so all you come away with is this half-hearted attempt at this thing that really is not very great. In fact, it's kind of disappointing. That's a second man. And then the last one, I'm just going, Judges chapter 6. And we'll stop with this one. This pattern is throughout the Bible and how God deals with us. This is the pattern. It's all the way through. It makes think about Jesus with Peter. What are you, Peter? I'm a fisherman. Oh, no, you're way more than that. Follow me, and I will make you into a fisher of men. But you have to follow me to do it. Otherwise, 9 to 5 in a fishing boat the rest of your life. Have fun. So here we have Judges chapter 6. And the situation's horrible. The economy's terrible. The housing market is so bad, they're hiding in caves. There's no jobs anywhere. The Chinese and the Muslims are taking over the world. And so verse 6, it tells the condition of the situation is bad. Horrible. Terrible. And listen, these are facts. It is terrible. It's horrible. No, it's no pretending. It's no like, oh, I'm a Christian now. I'm just not going to pay attention to this anymore. You have to. You have to pay the bills. Your wife sort of has to think you're thinking about the future, even though it doesn't look like it. Wait, honey, there's a football game on. We'll talk about the future later. And so it's factual. We're not pretending that it's any better. We're not using rose-colored glasses. It's real. But here's the thing. God is also real. So here's Gideon. It's in verse 6, it says, "So Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord." That word impoverished there means way more than they don't have any money. It means actually they're so beaten down they can't even look up in life anymore. It's like there's nothing to look up to. What's up there? No, look at the situation I'm in. Look at my family. Look at my marriage. Look at the situation I'm in. What's there to look up to there? That's impoverished. Their spirit is dead. And these are the people of God. That's who we're talking about here. These aren't pagans. These are Christians, so to speak. But that's where they are. That's how they feel. And so in desperation, they cry out to the Lord. It's interesting when people cry out or lament to God in Scripture, He always responds. When they complain in Scripture, do you remember what He does to them? He kills them. So if you have between those two options, if you're going to say something to God, I would lament. You have a chance of making it. You start complaining, it's dangerous ground. Complaining, gossiping, He's pretty harsh on. We're not so harsh on it, but He is. So, hey, did you complain? Yes, you're dead. Okay, in the desert. Thank you. And 3,000 other ones with you. So they lament and God hears them. In verse 10, "Also I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but you have not obeyed my voice." That word obeyed, there is Shema, and it means heard. Here's what he said. Not like you disobeyed, like I said this and you heard me and you didn't do it. You don't even hear me anymore. You can't even hear me when I talk. That's why you're in the situation that you're in. Do you understand that? It's not, did you obey me today? It's, did you hear me today? That's the question. And you didn't. You can't. That's the problem. That's the situation that you're in. That's why you don't know who you are. You've lost your identity of a kingdom of priests, and you've turned into just a bunch of homeless people. You've lost your identity. Verse 11, "Now the angel of the Lord came and sat under the tabernacle tree, which was in Ophrah," not Oprah, that's later, "which belonged to Joash, while his son Gideon threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord," okay, this is interesting, this word here, it says he came and sat under the tree. That word sat is not just the position of, you know, your butt's on the ground, but it means dwelt. He came to dwell with Gideon. When it says Jesus came and sat with them, the word is dwelt with them. When the angel goes and sits with Abraham, he's coming to dwell with him. That's what the angel is doing. And the angel of the verse 12, "And the angel of the Lord appeared to him," to Gideon, "and said," listen what he says, "the Lord is with you, mighty man of valor." That's the name that God calls Gideon, the mighty man of valor. Now Gideon looks around like, who are you talking to? You're not talking to me, I know. Mighty man of valor? That's his identity before God. The problem is he doesn't believe it or even know it. But so he's going to set him straight, though. Gideon's going to correct him and let him know what the facts are. "The Lord is with you, mighty man of valor." Gideon said to him, "Oh, my Lord, if the Lord is with us, if he's there, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles, which our fathers told us about, saying, did not the Lord bring you out of Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites." Which is absolutely wrong statement. Are they in the hands of the Midianites? Yes. Is it because the Lord has forsaken them? No. The Lord says, I will never leave you, never forsake you. So who's telling Gideon that the Lord has forsaken them? The enemy. The Lord can't work in this situation. I am telling you. That's how Satan talks. He's not going to work here. He's long gone. Because you're just not worth it to him. I mean, when's the last time you had prayed? You got to pray at least once a day or the Lord's going to forsake you. Like, well, I prayed like last year. Oh, he's gone. He's gone. And we're like, I know he's gone. And you know who's our sincere advisor in life? Satan. You know who's interpreting the facts of our life to us? Satan. And we don't hear God. And so Satan goes, man, you're never going to succeed here. I would just hide if I was you. I would just lay back and hide. Get a house somewhere out where there aren't any other people and hide. And you know what happens when you hide? The light that you have, you put it under a bushel and the darkness advances. Because darkness can't advance against light. But if light withdraws, dark automatically advances. The enemy's goal is to put every light that's sitting out here tonight under a bushel and say, you can't win. The Lord's forsaken you. Coward. Worthless person. Look at your family. It's awful. He's not here. And we go, I know. And I'm going to live my life like that's true. And we get this kind of crummy life. And then the Lord comes because we cry out and say, God, I just can't take this anymore. Like, this can't be right. I mean, I can't live in fear about everything all the time. Can I? Where are you? I want to hear your voice. Boom, he's right there. Right there. Gideon, I came here to tell you one thing. First, here's who you are to me. You're my mighty man of valor, despite everything you see around you. And Gideon challenges him. Then the Lord turned to him, verse 14, and said, listen to this, what he says. Go in the might that you already have and save Israel. Go in the strength, the power, the might that you already possess and save Israel. So here's two things that Gideon believes about himself that are wrong. Well, let's see what he says. Gideon said to him, oh, my Lord. So he said to him, oh, my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. Gideon's identity is exactly opposite of his true identity with God. Exactly opposite. You know what Satan's worried about with Gideon? That he'll figure out he's a mighty man of valor that already possesses the strength to deliver Israel. So Satan's goal is to make him feel like the worst of the weakest of the smallest and to live in fear. And you know what? Gideon buys it. But the Lord comes and says, no, let me tell you the facts about this situation. It is bad, but you're the man that can set him free. Let's go. Come on. Mighty man of valor. And if Gideon said, well, give me, you already have it. Well, give me brig. You already have it. You already have it all. Don't ask. You don't need to ask me for anything. You have it all. You've always had it. I knit you together in your mother's womb. And this is who you are. Mighty man of valor, filled with strength. I'm here to tell you the truth. And I'm here to be the one to be your advisor from now on. So Gideon's a little shaky about that. God doesn't care. You know, I got to test that. That's okay. Go ahead. Test me. Go ahead. He's not mad at me. But then he says to Gideon, now here's what I want you to do. I want you to go tear down the religion of your father. You know why? Because what's actually happening here is Gideon has inherited from his father a wrong belief about God. And so the first thing God is saying to Gideon, let's set that right. Because you know why? Because this is the only thing that'll save your father. You got to stand up. You got to say, this ain't right. So go and do it. And Gideon goes, can I do it at night? All right, do it at night. It doesn't matter what time you do it. Just do it. And so he goes and does it. And his father rises up to protect him. Suddenly his father becomes a man of valor. You know what happens when you, the mighty man of valor, go in the strength that you already possess to deliver a people? They rise up with you. Because they're like, wow, what's that guy doing? Like, wow, is that what it means to walk with God? That? Wow, that's different than I thought. and they start to follow. And Gideon lives his life, and his men and the people love him. They love him. Now, the question tonight is, what's the name that God calls you? First, what's the name that you live by, that the world calls you, that you just say, yeah, that's me. I'm lazy. I'm late all the time. All these names that we just take on. Lord, what's the name? I reject these names that the world calls me, that the enemy calls them. I reject them in the name of Jesus. What is the name that you call me, that you put together in my mother's womb, and let me go do it? I want to go do it. So I'm in the room with this, the lights are out, and the troll's going, turn your light on. And it's broke. And he's like, I'm going to shoot. Hold on. And I pray. It's like, God, what do we do? And the Lord's like, don't shoot. I just feel it. And I go to the troll, don't shoot. Hold on. And when we just wait in the darkness, and suddenly we hear this little girl start crying in the corner. And so Frank, the troll, pulls out his flashlight and flicks it on. And it is our guy. He's in the corner with a shotgun, but he's holding a girl in front of him because he knew we'd come in that room and shoot. And he figured that if we shot the girl, that it would so mess us up that he thought he could get past us. And it might have worked. I don't know. It would have messed us up. It would have got us in a lot of trouble. Who stopped us? God. Why? Because I have a future for you. I have plans for you. And if you will listen to me, I will take you through the worst of the times. So we arrested the guy, took the girl, belonged to one of the guys downstairs. He was the one going like that because he was terrified we were going to shoot her. And I got the guy in the car, put him in the car, and he goes, why didn't you guys shoot? You guys broke your training. This guy was a professional criminal. He said, you broke your training. And I said, I'll tell you why, because we would have. We wanted to, believe me, shoot you. But somehow God intervened, and he decided to save your life. I don't know why. Maybe for the life of the girl. I'm not sure why. But he had mercy on you. The guy went to prison for 45 years, 50 years. About 25 in, he sent me a letter because he couldn't figure out why God had intervened in that situation for him. He had just killed a guy. Had no interest in God. And so he went to a prison chaplain and told him the story and said, why would God do this? And that guy led him to Christ. And he was writing us to thank us for not shooting him that night. But that's because God speaks. And then with the Islamic Jihad guys, they said, what do you think about that? We're going to cut your throat. We're going to put you on trial in front of a cleric and cut your throat. What do you think about that? And I said, Lord, what do I think about that? And the Lord said, I'm not kidding you. The Lord said to me, he said, tell him that you're not afraid and that you want to be his best friend. And I said, Lord, that's two lies in a row. How can I say that? Neither of those are true. Like, is it okay because you said it? So I told him, you know what? I'm not afraid of this situation. I'm actually not. And I'm here to be your best friend. That's my goal. And the whole situation in the car changed. You know why? Because the kingdom of God broke right in through the darkness of that car and started to light it up. And I could see it on their faces. And then I said, and plus I'm not afraid of you guys. And the Lord's like, don't ad lib. Just say what I say. Don't get brave on me, you know. And the guy, Marwan's his name, he said, you want to be my best friend? That's what you want? You want to be our best friend? We're your enemies. And I said, yeah, that's what we do. And he said, then if you want to be my best friend, bring your wife tomorrow night to our secret place where they meet in Palestine alone. We'll send a driver. Come up there so you don't know where you are with our driver and trust us that we won't kill you both. You want to be my friend? And I said, I'll do it. Now, my wife happens to be Jewish, so this is a tough situation. So I said, okay, I'll do it. So he takes me, he says, where do you live? He takes me home. I go in and tell Donna what happened. And she's like, you told him where we live? You know, she didn't have the kingdom going yet. She was more like, they're going to kill us the next night. So we went, up there and spent way into the night with these guys. And I mean, it was a tough conversation. Believe me, you don't back down on what's right. And so we had a harsh conversation. And at the end of the night, the very men in the car that were going to cut my throat, they cooked on a grill outside on the hills overlooking Palestine. And they lined up the men and knelt down on their knees and served us. And they said, "We've never met anybody like you people." You know why? How I knew how to do that in that situation? Because God still speaks. He does. And then with James in that room, I said, "God, James just wants to know what his calling is. What's his calling?" And I said, "Just listen, James, just listen." And he had his head bowed and he had his fist clenched. And he's going, "It's nothing. It's nothing. It's always been nothing. It's always nothing. There's nothing there." And I thought, wow. I said, "Okay, whoa, calm down. Hang on a second." I said, Can you do this? Can you just imagine yourself standing before the cross where Jesus died? Can you just picture that in your mind?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Now, here's what I want you to do. I want you to think of everything in your life that causes you fear, guilt, and shame. Everything. And I want you to say it out loud, and I want you to put it down right at the bottom of the cross. Can you try that?" And he said, "All right, I'll try that." And it was kind of funny because when you know, the guy's been in prison so long, when you're doing your list of everything that causes fear, guilt, and shame, you know, it took a long time. And he went through it, man. He was like starting in third grade, first felony. Bam, bam. He's laying him down and he's got his head down. And as he's doing it, he says, "It's getting brighter. It's like it's getting brighter." And he keeps pouring this stuff out in front of the cross. And he goes, it's like I can see something. And I said, "James, ask God right now, when he looks deep into your soul, what does he see? Ask him." He goes, "I can't. I'm afraid to ask that. You don't know what I've done. Ask him right now, when he looks deep into your soul, what does he see? Ask him." And he yells it out. "What do you see?" And then he starts to cry. And he goes, "No way. No, no, no. It can't be true. It can't be true." And I said, "What does he see?" And James says, "He sees Jesus. How can that be? When he looks in my heart, that's what he sees." Boom. We pull out the Bible. We explain the righteousness of Christ, the exchange and salvation, the whole thing. And he's just crying his eyes out. And he goes, "It's like I'm free of this. Like I'm forgiven of this life." "Yes, you are." He goes, "It's incredible. It's amazing. Ask God what name he calls you. What's the name that he calls you? Ask him." He doesn't call you felon. He doesn't call you ex-con. He doesn't call you crack dealer. He doesn't call you pimp. Those are the names the world calls you. The police call you. We all call you. Our church calls you. What is the name he calls you? And he said, "God, what do you call me?" And he's listening. And I said, "Do you hear the name?" And he goes, "Yeah, but I don't know what the name is. I hear it, but I don't know what it means." "What is the name?" "Gideon." He goes, "What is that?" Boom. We jump into this passage, work through Gideon. Gideon's afraid in life. He's a man, a mighty man of valor. He's a fighter. He's a warrior, but he's afraid. And James goes, "That's my whole life. Fight, fight, fight. But I'm always actually terrified of the next day. Terrified in prison, you know?" And he said, "This is me." And he says, like, when he tells Gideon to go and save his people, is he telling me to go back into my neighborhood and save my people? And I said, "Yes." And he goes, "Oh my gosh." He said, "You know, when I was in third grade, my teacher called me forward to read a poem in the class. And I couldn't go because I felt I was stupid and I was so afraid. I ran out of the school and committed my first felony and never stopped." He goes, "You know what I realize right now? That was God calling me forward. Because I'm good at speaking to people and it was him telling me this is who I really was, but I was afraid of it." He goes, "I can see myself standing up in front of the kids in my neighborhood and saying, this isn't the right way. I can do this. I can do this." Yeah, go in the strength you have, James, and do it. 2 months after that, he married Sheena. And together, they work. He works mowing lawns. He gave up his car and his jewelry to mow lawns and to marry her and to love his kids. Only God can do that. But we can be the people that orchestrate that. Tonight, the question to God is, what is the name you call me? And what do I do with that? Thank you very much.